name is Tom, and I am an alcoholic and a druggie. Oh my, I last time I was in Yosemite, I was about 8 years old, and I wish I could tell you I was sober, but I had, someone reminded me, before that I had already discovered the wonders of mixing bourbon and Hershey syrup, and I don't think I had any of it when I was in the park at the time, but I was surely looking forward to the next time, I know that. And I don't remember anything about Yosemite other than playing on the river. You know, I mean, the fact there were cliffs and the Ahwahnee Hotel and people, I have no recollection. I think I had a little case of self-obsession. So it was a clear case of alcoholism waiting for alcohol, and that did happen. So when I came in Friday, I came in right around sunset, and I didn't know anything. I didn't know where anything was. I didn't know where the hotel motel was. I didn't know what to do. So my first response is feeling real inadequate, and that I was wrong, and I didn't bring anybody with me, and I should have brought, because you should bring friends to share this thing, so I felt guilty about being here. It was real wonderful. And then what saved me from sitting back in my room rocking back and forth, which is one of my favorite things when guilty, is some people on the program connected with me when I was checking in, and I had a sober dinner with them, and it was just wonderful, and I began connecting. But it takes me a little time to connect, and by last night it was a lot better, and I was able to be with people. I think I just get skittish or something. I don't know. I was on the program for a little while before I heard some people memorize the book, which has always baffled me because it's written down. You know, you can bring it with you. You know, you don't have to memorize it. If we only had one or two copies per 10,000 people, I could understand memorizing it, but anyway, and they throw off this AA shorthand. Well, as the promises talk about, as the promises, and everyone nods their heads, yes, the promises. Well, I'd been sober for 6 months or a year and a half, somewhere in there, and I started hearing this business about the promises. And I, of course, didn't ask about it. I wait for someone else to ask, because if I ask, you'll know I don't know. See, and so I don't want to do that. And someone, after about the 19th or 300th time the promises were mentioned, someone said, "What page are these on?" A newcomer, a desperate newcomer. "What page are these on?" And that's why I like going to meetings with newcomers, because they ask the questions I'm afraid to. And someone who'd been sober for a million years said, "Pages 83 and 84, third edition." So I went home and opened pages 83 and 84, and here is what I found. This comes, the promises fit in after working through the steps up to making amends. And when you're in the process of making amends, they say, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, the making amends, we will be amazed before we're halfway through. I think that's the first promise. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, it had been a while since I had been amazed by anything. I was a little burned out and a little cynical, didn't care much for people, and I had a little dose of self-obsession. As Eve mentioned last night, it's like being a little bit pregnant, you know. I mean, a little dose of self-obsession. And I can remember somewhere in early sobriety, the first couple of months, I suddenly started noticing things like sunsets.
And I turned to the person next to me and asked, how long have these been going on?
Some time now.
It's like coming into Yosemite. And one of the reasons for the first couple of hours here, I thought I was feeling inadequate, but it wasn't that. It was a sense of awe. Awe of the splendor and the beauty of what can be done with a few ice cubes, as Bob mentioned last night. You know, just and I'm capable of responding to situations like this. I mean, I find that wonderful. We will be amazed. So if any of you had a sense of amazement anywhere this weekend, you should know that the promises are being fulfilled in you. I think that's real true. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. I didn't care. I wasn't interested in freedom or happiness. I just didn't want to drink again. You know, bottom line, I didn't want to drink again. And whatever you have to do, I was willing to do it. Forget this freedom, happiness nonsense. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. Ha! You know, I had never heard anything more foolish in my life. I had nailed the door shut on a lot of stuff. And a lot of people. They were inconvenient. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. Again, to me that sounded like a Hallmark card. Who cares? You know. It's funny, you know, that serenity piece. See, when I came into the program, all I wanted was not to ever have to drink again. Bottom line. I can remember I was taking a class. I got sober when I was 29 years old. I had just completed my second year of the study of theology for ordination as a Roman Catholic priest in the Jesuit order at the University of California's Graduate School of Theology. And I was up to here with a lot of stuff, you know. And I came into the fellowship and at my first meeting, which was in Oakland at 2910 Telegraph at Central Office, I wondered, it was an old-timers meeting. I was the youngest person in the room by 1,000 years. I was very hairy. Everyone else had crew cuts and tattoos. And I wandered into this place, and I can remember at that first meeting, I didn't feel hope. Excuse me, I did feel hope. Some people say they come in and feel a sense of wonder or home or safe. I felt hope. And hope for me is a different kind of feeling. Hope is not a good feeling for me, and part of that comes from my tradition. When I was in fourth or third grade and I went to Catholic school, a lot of things are explained to third graders that are real important, like, you know, what happens after you die with all this conviction. And we were told that if you died and were real, real, real extraordinarily fine, you went directly to heaven. Now, the two people that got that prize were Jesus and his mother. If, on the other hand, you were really awful, with no redeeming features whatsoever when you died, you went directly to hell. You did not pass go. You did not pass, you know, collect $200. What about the 95% of us in the middle? Well, there was a place called purgatory. So, and purgatory is where you went to get cleaned up, you see. So we would ask as third graders with huge eyes, you know, all this is being explained to us, that what is the difference between hell and purgatory? And they were told, hell is a place of fire, brimstone, anguish, suffering that goes on forever. Purgatory, on the other hand, is a place of fire, brimstone, suffering, anguish, and torment that only goes on for 100 zillion years. Therefore, it was explained to us, purgatory was a place of hope. Now, so at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, when I say I felt hope, do you get the picture? You know? And what occurred, the hopeful reflection, as these people were chattering and laughing and talking and being so glad to be alive on a Friday night without a drink. And I hadn't had a drink in 2 days, so I was feeling wonderful. What occurred to me was this. It said, Tom, if you go to these meetings forever and never have another drink or joint or pill for as long as you live, and you're going to live to be real old. If you do that, the hope is it won't get any worse. And in August of 1976, that seemed like a bargain. I was willing. I knew I'd never laugh again. I knew I'd never have a good time again. I knew I'd never relax. I knew the headache would never go away. I knew food would never stay down. But as long as it wouldn't get worse. Thank you. 6 months later, I was taking a class taught by this madman. And it was a seminar, and it was on the theology of hope. And when you read about the theology of hope, you have to read a lot of German theologians, and a lot of German theologians are very angry about losing the Second World War. This is a real theme for them if you want to key into their problem. Anyway, at the end of the class, we were to share intimately something that we found personally hopeful. Hopeful. And there, you know, people were talking about stuff and so forth. Just wonderful Hallmark card stuff. And I remember saying, and there were like 5 or 6 other people in the class, I said, I'm real hopeful right now that I can die without being institutionalized. And they all looked horrified. Because and that was one of, like, I was, 6 or 7 months sober at the time. It occurred to me, that is the reason why we go to meetings, you know. Because we know what that means. Earth people just, see, they don't know what it really means. The wonder and the glory that's really involved in getting through any 24-hour period without having to drink or use or pee on yourself. They just don't know. So, I'm all for hope. The promises go on. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That seemed theoretical enough for me to buy. You know, I mean, also it was not threatening how my experience can benefit you, little brown brother. You know, that sentence is the foundation for the colonial empire. I mean, I can hold on to that. Feeling very superior in helping you, absolutely. I love that. God forbid I should just be a drunk, you know. It then says that feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. I was horrified. absolutely horrified. See, useless and self-pity is what I did best. And when they told me it was going to be taken away, my best friend after bourbon, you know, I was simply horrified. I just prayed it wouldn't happen to me. And I'd like to say, in behalf of feeling useless and having self-pity, that it is a wonderful way to spend a weekend. It really is, when no one calls. Of course, you haven't called them. Anyway, they come back to visit now. They used to be permanent residents. Now they just come back to visit. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. I felt guilty with that. Because, see, I'd been in the seminary forever, and that should have already happened. You know, and I knew I was a bad person, because I didn't care about them at all. I just didn't want to drink again. You know, that was that simple. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Scared me. Again, I just prayed this. I had thought for my attitudes. They were hard-won attitudes. And I still regularly, and I'm over 9 years sober, I still regularly mix up having principles and holding on to resentments. I still mix that one up. What I found, that Eve mentioned it last night. I mean, there is a lot more to not drinking than not drinking. And I hated that for a very long time. And, it was one of the articles talking about the program of recovery in AA. It was in one of the magazines circulated nationally. I forget which one. Maybe it was Newsweek. And they said, you know, what do you have to change if you want to stop drinking? And the answer is everything. You know, just everything, that's all. If there are any newcomers here, I didn't say that. Just keep coming back. You know? What I need to know on that is, I mean, I have found recovery is real slow. I mean, like glaciers going through Yosemite are real slow. And slow is real. I'm a speed junkie, too. I thought if it wasn't 90 miles an hour, it wasn't worth paying attention to. And slow is real, and real takes time, and we are going to be alive for a very long time, and bit by bit things change, and the changes are permanent. And I have great hope in that slow recovery process. I also believe, right, as of today, that the first 5 years of sobriety are real early years of sobriety. You know, and maybe in a couple of years I'm going to conclude that the first 10 years of sobriety are real early years of sobriety. But it's true. It then says, fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. I've heard that this way. Fear of people will leave us permanently and we'll all get rich. And that's not what the promise is. It says fear of people will leave us. Now, it also returns, you know. But I found it goes away again. I was at one of my strongest times of real fear and inadequacy was this past spring. I went to the Denver Young People's Roundup Conference. And I went in Friday night and just got catatonic. I was, because I knew I'd know no one there. And there were all these alcoholics from places like, you know, Denver. Amazing. I didn't know these people. And I had, and the fear hit real, real strong. And I've learned what to do about that. First of all, I respect fear tremendously. And some fears are real healthy to have. On the top of, the dome, there's an honest fear that kind of comes to you. That keeps you alive. But what I did is I went to my room and I kind of breathed deep for a while and walked around. And then when I had a little bit of presence of God, I wander out and I looked at people.
And I look at faces, and if I look at a lot of recovering faces, some of the fear starts to go away. And then what I need to do is find some poor sucker frozen against the wall. And I can wander up and say, hello. And start a conversation. It's never a real warm conversation because both of us are busy being terrified and self-obsessed. But it starts, and give me about 18 hours and most of the fear goes and I can function. You know, fear goes. This fear, the other fear is fear of economic insecurity will pass away. I met one guy in Marin County who had done his fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh step a year ago and still hadn't made $100,000. And he concluded he needed to take another fifth step. And I said, that's just not true. It says the fear of economic insecurity passes. I'm still very economically insecure for a lot of reasons, many of them voluntary. And the difference is I'm no longer terrified about it. I still bounce checks. It hasn't happened in a couple of months, but it does. And the reason I still bounce checks is because when we were learning how to subtract, I was busy. Kind of like being here playing, you know, in the water, busy, don't bother me, what dome. Vague recollection of Camp Curry. What I do now when I bounce a check is I call the bank. I no longer have to change banks. Say. And that's real progress. I'm of the opinion also that someone is a financial success if they pay their bills. Period. You know, period. We have this, I mean, there's this awful thing where, you know, I think it's an awful thing, but if you, God really loves you, you know, you'd be very rich and very white and very blonde. And I think that is spiritual cancer. I really do. I think if anyone was going to be the first millionaire, to my understanding, it would have been Jesus. And Scripture tells us that he didn't have a place to regularly lay his head down. He was a vagabond, you know. Probably had a headband wrapped around his head and, you know, hanged out asking for spare change. We forget that. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. Now, that promise started coming true for me. It was one of the first ones that I noticed. And it came like this. It was had to do with the holidays.
The holidays are coming.
Yes. I remember I got through my first Thanksgiving was not a real traumatic experience because I didn't go to my family. But Christmas and all those things are just such so awful. And we got through my first one sober, and I was around 3 or 4 or 5 months sober. Got through the first holiday, and somewhere around March, I was just finally realizing that I made it alive. And someone explained that it was going to come back next year at the same time. And I was horrified, just horrified. So intuitively knowing how to handle situations that used to baffle you. The first intuitive solution I had to real complicated situations like family gatherings was, when it gets uncomfortable, you can leave. I never knew that. I never knew. In fact, if any gathering gets uncomfortable, you can leave. I thought I always had to stay because I never knew what would happen next. Maybe someone wonderful would show up, you see. Maybe something embarrassing would happen. You know, so you always wanted to stay until, you know, the very end, until there I was drunk. To find out you could leave. I found out in terms of just holidays in general that the great salvation for me has been that I only have to participate to the degree that I am comfortable. And when I'm no longer comfortable, I don't have to participate. I went for several years without any celebration whatsoever of Christmas, outside of liturgical, which I did in a church and wished everyone a Merry Christmas and went home and watched TV. I was just very spooked by it. One of the worst Christmases I had, I had to show up because family was there and so forth. My family is Irish Catholic on one side and Swedish Lutheran on the other. We get everyone together.
and smile. Real tense. Little alcoholism in the family. We never talked about it. For us, having alcoholism in the family was like having a rhinoceros in the living room. Everybody knew it was there. It's hard to miss. But it's also true that if you suddenly said, "Oh my God, look at that rhino," you're the one that had to take it out. Okay. So no one volunteers for that job. Instead, what we do is we learn how to play Let's Decorate the Rhino. You can put tablecloths over them, and this time of year, put cute little lights around the horn, and it looks just like a tree. You walk around it, of course, and rhinos sleep a lot when they do get up and run around the house. What we had to do was throw ourselves up against the wall, preferably in the form of the cross, and wait for the rhino to stop moving. And when the rhino stopped moving, we'd come down and say, or my mother would say with her chorus, "Act like nothing happened." Those are the words she wants on her tombstone. You know, "Act like nothing happened." Amazing. So I went to one Christmas, and this was 2 or 3 years sober, and it was in a little town in Northern California, and a lot of people were there who did not like each other. And I ended up sitting down at the table next to 3 people who were rabid anti-Catholics. And they kept telling me how the Pope was Antichrist, and I tried to explain to them that I didn't care. And it went on, you know, from there. They had the TV turned on and the stereo all the time, constant noise in the house. You have to have noise to distract from everything. Kids screaming. Someone who usually drinks was not drinking, so they were a lot of fun. Anyway, I left there, and I turned to my parents, who were very very nice people, but they get overwhelmed by life. And I turned to them, and I said, "I'm going to a meeting," and they knew what kind of a meeting that I was going to. And I went to this one in this little town in Northern California, and there were 3 other people there. One was a woman who was from somewhere in the exact same situation I was, visiting family. You know, eyes that wide, you know. "Oh, you're home for the holidays." You know? "How'd you tell, you know? Your knuckles, dear." The chairman, the guy who was secretary, it was a little discussion meeting, the guy who was secretary in the meeting was about 300 years old and was a member of the National Rifle Association. And had an accent that was exactly like Lyndon Johnson's. Now, I used to drink over Lyndon Johnson for years over. I could just hear that tone, and I would reach for a bottle and go through a lot of stuff. See what I mean about principles and resentments? I mean, they just all get bogged up inside of me. So I tried to tune him out, and the guy, the only local who was at the meeting who wasn't Lyndon, was this fellow who was sober about 9 days, and anyone have a topic? His topic was, "Why won't you people let me bring my knife into the meeting?" Merry Christmas, you know. God. So I drove back to Berkeley, where we have real AA, and I'm the realization that I had was I never have to do that again. Never have to do that again. As I tell folks, over 120 years ago, President Lincoln freed the slaves, passed the word. You know, most of us missed that information somewhere. And I didn't even celebrate it all because I couldn't. I was just too much of a basket case. And then after about 3 years of not celebrating, I bought a cactus about that high and decorated it. And then, you know, eased my way back into it and finally started going back to spend time with my parents and very small amount of the family Christmas Eve. And I found that I am fine with my family for up to 3.5 hours. And then I get nuts, which is my problem, not theirs. And therefore, I go for up to 3.5 hours and have a wonderful time. And I really enjoy it. And then I leave and I go to a meeting. And I've been able to do that for the last couple of Christmases. And I'm just realizing, from being a Scrooge and a cynic, I've grown to really love the holidays. And that's because I've learned something about limits and something about what I'm capable of and something about intuitively knowing how to handle situations that used to baffle me. I still don't go to a lot of cocktail parties because I just get nuts there, so I don't go. I haven't sent Christmas cards in 10 years. Last year, I bought some, though. And if you find that it's just too awful to do the holidays this year, relax. Next year, they'll be back. Try it again, you know. The other thing that intuitively occurred to me, and this was, I was almost a year sober, and an Episcopal seminarian explained this one to me. He said, if it's after 11 o'clock at night, and it seems like a good idea, it's not. If it helps, use it. This is why I always carry a watch. Okay. The last promise is we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. And that's the first promise that came true for me. God's a funny story, I think. My problem, and I think most of us have problems with God. I mean, any significant relationship has problems. And I had a lot of difficulty for a while as I was getting used to me, about my getting familiar with me, finding out who's home, you know. I discovered that I had real strong pro and con feelings about my family. And I had real strong pro and con feelings about my denomination. And I had real strong pro and con feelings about my country. And that confused me because I thought that well put together people always felt one thing towards anything, you know? I mean, that's, I watched Leave It to Beaver too often. And I find out now what mixed emotions means for me, it's not good or bad. It means simply that I have a significant relationship. That's what it means. And these are relationships that I will be dealing with for my whole life. So I have to take them very seriously. And I have that kind of a relationship with God. Sometimes God I find thrilling, and sometimes we're just not on speaking terms. And I find that real wonderful. Teresa of Avila, who is no slouch, in terms of prayer, she's a 16th century mystic. She regularly used to have little conversations with God. And she would, she was going from point A to B, and her horse shied, and she was knocked off her horse, and she landed on the ground, and she got up, and she shook her fist at heaven, and she said, God, no wonder you have so few friends. Look how you treat them. I think if I'm having a bad day, I've got to let God know about it, you know, rather than, I can't get mad at God. You bet I can, you know. It happens on, that's how I know it's significant. Anyway, this God, see, I've always believed in God. I didn't talk to God for a couple of years because God did not meet my high expectations. But we have always believed, but somehow I picked up, and maybe it's watching too many movies or something, but this John Wayne kind of spirituality where spiritual people are strong people, you know, and that the American male ideal is to be completely independent, leave me alone. You see, out there on the prairie with my gun and my horse and my pack of Marlboros, you know, I'm fine. That hits a real deep chord in me, and I have to really be careful of it. I used to think that a mature man would have this kind of a relationship with God. Me to God as Washington is to Moscow. Each one knows the other's there. But let's not get involved, you know. When I'm in real need, I'll sign a treaty. I'll do anything. Give me out of this. But, you know, let's not get dependent, you know, because that's un-American. Well, I found out my whole attitude towards God had to change very, very much. I always believed in God. I never knew what to do with God. What I tried to do for years was figure God out. I tried figuring God out in English and in Greek and in Latin and in German and in Spanish and in Swedish. And I still stayed drunk, you know. Very discouraging. And when I came to the program, people explained to me, you know, God, prayer, God. And I froze because I just, it didn't work for me. You know? I mean, I could pray and believe all I wanted and not get sober. And therefore, I'm very grateful for the second step of the program, which says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I didn't go looking for God. Instead, I put everything I knew about God on a back burner, and I went out looking for a power greater than myself. And I found one. Took very quickly, as a matter of fact, it was provided. It was a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that took place on Wednesday night in Berkeley, and it was called the Wild Bunch. Also called the Open Ward by those of us in the know. And it was a meeting where everybody was present. I mean, we had real old people and we had real young people. We had university professors and we had people who never graduated from high school. We had black people and white people and brown people. We had Catholics and ex-Catholics and Jews and Protestants and Marxists and ex-Marxists. It was an incredible combination of people. We had women and men gay and straight. One meeting we counted up 15 different sexual persuasions in the room at one time. It was wonderful. It really was, you know. And that was not a big night. What was clear was that there was a representative of every facet of the human race in that room, and if everybody could be there, so could I. If everybody could be there, so could I. I'd walk into the room and I'd feel the love and the acceptance. And that's what I needed in a higher power. And so for the next almost a year and a half, 2 years, I used that meeting as my higher power. When life got awful, I knew all I had to do was get to that meeting on Wednesday night and it would get better. I went to a lot of other meetings, but that was the one that healed me. And I was in that room, and I put in that room the place where I had what we call spiritual awakenings. And I always thought, see, when I was growing up, I'd go into churches of my denomination, and a number of them had statues and stuff. And I'd sit in the back waiting for an answer, meaning, you know, clarity. I want an answer that I can tell people and be superior. So I would do things. I'd look at one of the statues and say things like, if there really is a God, wave back. And sometimes they would, you know. Then I'd say, do it again. You know, I'm no pushover. But in that room is what I would call the spiritual awakenings, and I had several in my first year of early sobriety. The first one is I looked around the room. I was 6 or 7 or 8 months sober. I looked around the room one night and noticed that I was not the only person in the room. Might not seem like a biggie to you, but that was real powerful for me because I've always been alone and isolated. And my arrogance was the arrogance of I'm no good. And I always really believed and felt that if you knew who I was, you'd ask me to leave. Always believed that. And I came to the clarity was like this. I looked around the room and I said, every woman and man in this room has a right to be here. I am a man in this room. I have a right to be here too. And it was like liberation. It was liberation. I was stunned by that. And I had a feeling of belonging for the first time. That was around 6 or 7 months sober. After that, a little while later, my next spiritual awakening, I suddenly realized that not only had I not had a drink or a joint or a pill in almost 9 months, but it had been a long time since I had a desire for a drink or a joint or a pill. And I didn't do it. That was the spiritual insight. I didn't do it. And I therefore concluded, my God, there must be a higher power in my life. Not something I can figure out in 5 languages, thank you, but an actual experience of God. This is why I'm thrilled. I'm very happy that when this second step was written, it said we came to believe. It doesn't say we came to feel. Because I didn't feel God's presence for a long time. But I came to believe that there's a power greater than myself that can restore me to sanity. And sanity, you know. I hated the word. I thought sanity meant dull. Sanity meant watching Lawrence Welk a lot. Sanity meant living a tight little life with no loose ends. You know, sanity meant having it all clear. And I just hated that point. I went into therapy when I was 3 months sober. And by the way, the book says we can. I'd like to point that out. You don't believe me, but on page 133, it says, God has abundantly supplied this world with fine doctors, psychologists, and practitioners of various kinds. Do not hesitate to take your health problems to such persons. I had them, and I went. And the thing, I mean, emotionally, I was a basket case. Before I discovered alcohol, one of the ways I learned to survive was shutting down. And my family did use those three hallowed principles of don't talk, don't trust, and don't feel that we talk about a lot sometimes in ACA meetings. We also had the fourth one, smile. So we did that a lot. And I still find whenever I'm under attack, I'll smile because that's what I learned at home. You know, they'll keep away if they think you're harmless. So when the alcohol was removed from my system, and I didn't, you know, I didn't come into Alcoholics Anonymous in a lot of pain. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous numb. Numb from head to toes. I didn't feel anything other than awful, and I had felt awful for years. But when alcohol and non-habit-forming marijuana are depressants, and when you take both of them at a daily basis for years, you get real depressed. You know, doctor, why am I so depressed? When they're out of the system, you start waking up again. I was hospitalized. Can you imagine? I was me, you know. I was hospitalized for alcoholism, went through a 21-day program, and the unit next to my unit, where we were just drying out and I was too young to be an alcoholic, the burn unit. And the burn unit in a hospital is the most serious unit in a hospital. I mean, I'm of that opinion. I think there is no more severe harm that can happen to the body than a real bad burn. And if you've been burned real, real bad, like all over your body, you don't feel pain. You really don't. You leak a lot. You can get infected real fast and you can die pronto, but you don't feel a lot of pain, and that's because all your nerve endings have been burned off. When the nerve endings start growing back, you feel pain. And this is why you'll see these incredible women and men who work on the burn unit as staff. They'll be going around to people who are screaming in agony, and they'll tell them, this pain means you're getting well. This too shall pass. Stick with this. It's just awful right now. See, I needed to know that because after I was about 3 months sober and the numbness wore off, I started feeling, and I didn't feel good. I felt awful. I felt rage. I felt much more rage than fear. Fear would be the breaker, you know, would come in just to give rage a rest. Anything, I can't stand, I love, I hate, all these emotions. And I went into therapy to help me try to read my emotions because I did not know how to do it. And I talked to a very wise man named Leonard, and I would see Leonard twice a week at 8 o'clock in the morning. And on one occasion, after I figured maybe I should try to trust this man, I said, Leonard, do you think I'm normal? And he looked at me with wise Jewish eyes and said, normal is 98.6. And I knew I did it wrong, you know. I've asked the wrong question. Well, now, for years, I believed normal is 98.6, and it is. But there's one other normal that I'd like. Normal also means whatever is going on in your neighborhood. That's normal. And it has no other meaning. So if you talk about normal a lot, people will know where you live. In my neighborhood, one of my obsessions are things political. In my neighborhood in November of 1984, we went 84% Mondale Ferraro. Can you imagine? Can you imagine? We thought that was normal. And then we read the papers the next day and found out that in the rest of the United States, from sea to shining sea, there was a disagreement. I was horrified. You know? Do you know anyone who voted for them? No. How'd they win? We didn't know. Because that was normal, you know? So what I have as normal in my life, other people would have arrested. So let's just realize that. And AA reflects the neighborhoods, you know? And that's... So when you travel around, like NVE traveling, you find out people really do... It's the same 12 steps, but we do things differently. I went to a friend of mine who was ordained a priest in Chihuahua, Mexico, and I went down to go attend his ordination a couple of years ago. And Chihuahua is backwater Mexico, and this was the backwater of the backwater, a couple of hundred yards off the paved road. And the people got together and built their own thing out of concrete and made their own electricity, very politically correct. And anyway, the colonia was there. And they had a little AA clubhouse that was a room, just a basic room, hard earth floor and concrete walls, and they had pictures of Guillermo W. and El Dr. Bob on the wall. And I was a resident Yankee, I mean, the traveler from El Norte, and I was the tallest person in the room. And I sat down, and they were tired of each other's stories, so they were going to play 20 questions. What's AA like in the North? And so, using the Berkeley experience, I spoke on behalf of all of you. I want you to know that. How we do it in the North. And I went on, and they would ask questions. And my Spanish is not very good. And so my friend Bill would translate, we were not, and I was feeling like, you know, I felt like the New York Central office. It was wonderful. About 20 minutes into my shtick, there was this old dog there. And in real slow Spanish, using small words so I could understand, he said, "Do you folks use the same 12 steps?" And I looked over at the wall. They had Los Doce Pasos, and it took me about a minute to read them in Spanish. And I was going, and I turned and I said, "Yeah, we do have the same 12 steps." And he said, "Then you'll probably stay sober." Oh, my. Anyway, back to normal. You know, what's normal? Leonard and I continued our discussion, and he said, "Tom, I think what you're looking for is the word healthy. Are you healthy?" And that was a word I'd never used in relation to myself, because I've always had sickness fantasies where I've had secret diseases, and you know, late at night I'd hear them eating my leg and so forth. I knew, you see. And that still happens occasionally when I wake up in the middle. I know it's terminal, and you know, oh, God, got it. So that... And that's just my mind having a meeting. So I've learned not to take it all that seriously. But he said that the word sane comes from the Latin word sanus. And sanus means health. Sanitation comes from there. Sane comes from there. When you're sane, you're emotionally and psychologically healthy. You know, I'm waiting. You know, I'm waiting for any identifiable word there. And I said, "Well, how do you spot healthy people?" And he said, "Healthy people can do three things." He said, "Healthy people are capable of working. Healthy people are capable of loving. And healthy people are capable of playing. If you can work, love, and play, you're a pretty healthy person." And I said, "Go on, you know, I'm waiting." And he said, "What your alcoholism did, Tom, was it destroyed your ability to work. You couldn't leave your room." And I said, "I could too, you know." And he said, "I'm talking about 2 days in a row." He was getting picky, you know. As far as loving went, I listen to too many country western songs to have any healthy idea of what love is. And the one that I love, there are several. I should write down the words as they go, but there's one that the real pain of love. You don't know love till it's chilled you to the bone, till it's turned you inside out, till it's smashed you on the floor. That's love, you know, real love. And so love has always had this tremendous hormonal roller coaster quality to it. I was attending a conference in San Diego, and this guy was explaining what he called the addiction there. And he said, it goes like this. We get sober, and we have short-term gain followed by long-term pain followed by disillusionment. I'll never do that again. Call your sponsor. If you ever see me even talking to anyone who looks like him or her, slap me. I'll never do it again. Never. But then it's Saturday night, and you aren't at a meeting, and you're restless, and the moon's full, and you're pacing back and forth. And so you decide you're going to go out and get some short-term gain. You know? Followed by long-term pain. Followed by disillusionment. Followed by agitation. I'm convinced that when you meet someone who's been married 13 times, that's the pattern, you see? And it's the same thing we can do with people. I've done that with people as I did with alcohol.
Short-term gain, couple of quick drinks. Long-term pain, can't get off the stuff. Disillusionment, I'll never drink another drink. And then by dinner time tonight, agitated, I think I'll have another one. You know, it's the same cycle. And so to break the cycle, the switch is to agree to some short-term pain, followed by long-term gain.
Like, what does that mean?
Friend of mine.
Yeah. Pictures. I want pictures.
A friend of mine started dating when he was around 2 years sober, and he dated 5 women in the course of that year, and 3 of the 5 were suicidal, or attempted suicide. And it occurred to him that this was probably slightly higher than average odds. And maybe he was attracted to suicidal women. Maybe that was the problem, you know. And so he had to realize that what he would do is go into a room full of people and he would see her. And his breath would go away and his pulse would start pounding. And he knew that sex would be so good, pigeons would fly out his ears. I mean, this was going to be fabulous, you know. And his therapist told him, the next time you see a person like that, don't even say hello. That's a drink with 2 legs. Instead, look around the room for someone who to you seems a little dull. Wander up to him or her and say, hello, have a conversation, ask him or her out. Ask him out 10 times. The only object being conversation. Get to know each other. His response was, you're ruining my social life. Right? But what it was that's the short-term pain. So you can have the long-term gain. It's like going through the food line, you know, last night. And you see there's, you know, all the eclairs and all the chocolate cake and an apple. Choice is clear, right? Yeah. Or why so many of us have such difficulty stopping smoking. We can't stand the short-term pain. We prefer emphysema. It's incredible. It's incredible. So, thought I'd mention that. As far as the loving goes, learning how to love somebody, it means learning how to wish somebody well. Love is not feelings. Feelings help, but love is actions. Love is how you behave towards someone else. It's not how you feel all alone in your room. It's acting without manipulation. It's acting honestly. It's acting gently, one day at a time, giving where it's possible and setting honest limits and, you know, allowing reciprocation. Some of us, 7, 8, 10, 12 years sober, even get into relationships where there's give and take. It's incredible, and it happens, and you see it, and it's a clear sign of God's action in our lives. As far as playing goes, I was raised to believe, this is the work ethic, the Swedish Lutheran background, play is a waste of time. Real people work. Good people work a lot. And real good people never take time off. That's how it worked in my life. And so I can stay real busy but get nothing done. Learning how to play, my shrink told me, if I didn't learn how to play, I'd never get well. And I didn't know what to do. Where do you start? How do you learn? What do people do? And he said, you have to go out and look at what people on the planet do for play. And what may be, playing is very intimate stuff, by the way, because what's play for me might be work for you. It's very individualized. I find for play, now at 9 years sober, what I do for play, in addition to coming back to Yosemite next year, is I cook.
See, now, I don't do that for a living. If I were a woman who had 12 kids, that would not be play. But it's playful for me because I live in a community with 5 other priests, and we live in Oakland, and you know, 2 nights a week I cook, and it's always a surprise. Who knows what's going to happen? It's kind of fun. I also find working in a garden for me is playful. Because the word play here, I don't want to convey wasting time. The word that I would put underneath it is the word recreation. And recreation is that thing that recreates my insides, that recreates my soul, that nourishes me, that allows me to live, that allows me to connect. So for some of us, that's going to the ocean. For some of us, that's backpacking. For some of us, that's collecting stamps. For some of us, it's going to museums. There's a zillion things to do for play. I have not been bored since after I was a year sober. Because all of a sudden things start opening up and I start trying new things. Like the maple mousse, you know, at the Iwani. It's just a sensation. I might have to go back and have a lot more of it fast, you know, for some short-term gain. And the working thing, learning that we can change jobs. I think a lot of us get sober. I was a teacher. In fact, a thrill for me. There's a drunk here that I taught 12 years ago. And we were both probably drinking a little at the time. And it's a... As I taught for 7 years, 4 of them sober, and I found out that things I did drinking, I can't do sober. And therefore, a lot of us get sober and find out that jobs no longer fit. That's terrifying for a man. Perhaps also for a woman, but I haven't had that experience in this lifetime. Because a lot of males, I am what I do. And an unemployed man is a castrated man. That's one of the biggest crises, I mean, as far as things social go. It's not just you don't have a job. You don't have an identity. And when a lot of us go through periods of unemployment or where we can't work, it's not a minor event in the life of an American male. It's a major one. Well, finding out in work as a teacher, I could change jobs. My real understanding of work right now is work means that you're able and capable of showing up when you agree to, and doing what you agree to. Those are the two elements of work. Some jobs, are 9 to 5 Monday or Friday. Other jobs are weekends. Other jobs are evening. I know one fellow I was sponsoring for a while had the swing shift, and he was embarrassed by it. Because it wasn't 9 to 5 Monday to Friday. That's a real job, you know. So work is very big. And learning how, and my style of working may not be your style of. I found, as I was restored to a position where I could work some, love some, and play some. Sometimes I'm better than others. Sometimes I don't do that, but I'm capable. It was a clear sign to me that there was a power greater than myself involved in my life. That's the proof of the existence of God in my life. In fact, I don't see it in me as much as I see it in you. I'm amazed and filled with wonder when I see addicts and alcoholics who come in like zombies, the living dead, and in a short period of time get restored to a place where they begin to eat regularly and food stays down. Where they start showing up for work, where they start looking at people in the eye, and where they can touch one another without fear of breaking. I think that's tremendous liberation. And for me, that's what's clear about the power and the love of God in our lives. Last story. A few years ago, Leonard and I, who my therapist for my first 9 months, my shrink. After I left his couch, I became friends with him, and we are still pretty good friends, and we do stuff together. And a few years ago, Leonard is of the Jewish faith, and Leonard was taking a series of courses at his synagogue taught by an Orthodox rabbi. And so I figured I'd really like to go. I've always felt a real kinship with things Jewish, intellectually and emotionally, figuring that anything I learn about things Jewish, I'm learning about my own denomination, because the sources of Scripture and my whole church is Jewish. So I went for a lot of reasons. And the course was in Jewish theology, and it was being taught by the Orthodox Rabbi of Berkeley. Now, this was not a raving liberal, I assure you. This he knew I was a priest. Most people in the class were either people who were born Jewish but had never done anything about it. So it was like going back to their roots. It was a rediscovery. It was finding out how any of this works. And Gentiles who were converting. And then there was me. And so the rabbi and I talked on a couple of occasions, and he knew my background. Anyway, in one class, the rabbi was taking questions, and one woman in the class raised her hand, and she said, "Rabbi, what is a blessing?" And I don't know what you know about rabbis, but rabbis don't usually fire back answers. There's a tradition instead that's very old of answering a question with a question. So questions like, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar? A good rabbi would say, whose picture's on the coin? Okay. Caesar's. Give it to him. Next. You see how it goes? And if you can't answer with a question, what you're supposed to do is tell a story. Two men run the road to Jericho. Okay. Well, what's a blessing? And the rabbi stopped for a second and fooled with his beard, which is why we have beards. And they're wonderful, wonderful. And he said, Moses wrote that when God created the heavens and the earth, it took 6 days. And at the end of each day of creation, God looked at what God had made and said, this is good. This is good. So God made the big light and the little light and said it was good. And God drew dry land out of the water and said it was good. And God made sheep and cows and goats and avocados and said they were good. And on the last day of creation, God created the human being and didn't say anything. And the rabbi said, any conclusions? And one of the people in the class said, people are no good. And the rabbi said, that's a possible conclusion. And that's why it's a bad translation. He said, in English, the word good means too many things. You have a good book, you know, the good book, a good buy, buy this, goodbye, a good person, a good soda. What a good day, have a good day. What good means too many things in English, the rabbi said. In Hebrew, and then he looked at me and said, which is what God spoke. He said, in Hebrew, God said, it is tov, T-O-V, as in Victor, tov. What does tov mean? The rabbi said, tov means something is complete. Tov means something is whole. Tov means something is entire. Tov means something is the way it is, and it just can't be any different. Cows are created tov. The earth is created tov. Artichokes are tov. The moon is tov. But people, he said, people are created incomplete. People are created with a lot of empty spaces. This is why the rabbi said, by the way, that some of the rabbis are convinced that this is still the sixth day of creation. Because there's still so much to do. And the reason we're part of the sixth day is because women and men are necessary to complete the creation, to do the work, foundational work, to build a world where it's safe to be a child. He went on to say, as you travel along life's path, as you trudge the road of happy destiny, as you're on your journey, as you're making your pilgrimage, as you're doing what's in front of you, anything that gets behind you and pushes you forward, anything that gets in front of you and drags you ahead, anything that gets down deep inside of you and pushes you and shoves until suddenly there's more room. Anything that does that is a blessing. And he said, lots of times blessings don't feel good. And lots of times you don't know it's a blessing until it's long gone. And you look back at a circumstance or a happening or an event that you knew was going to kill you. And you find out that it opened doors for you that you never even knew were there. When he said that is when it became clear to me how and why alcoholism is the greatest blessing in my life. Because it found me a very scared, very brittle, very bigoted, very angry man. And today it's better. Today it's better. What we're supposed to do at any meeting is share experience and strength and hope. My experience, strength, and hope is simply this. If you go to lots of meetings, if you don't drink in between meetings, and if you don't use no dope, one day at a time, we will grow into persons who are capable of working and loving and playing.
My name is Katina, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm deeply honored to be here to share with you the Lord's Prayer. If you'll all stand, please, and join me in singing the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, give our debtors,
us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.